Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The better you do, the faster this whole nightmare will end.
President Trump reverses himself to extend social distancing rules amid some cautious positive signs in Europe. I asked the expert who wrote the pandemic playbook for the White House, why was it left on the shelf? Then, leadership in times of crisis, how four-star General Stanley McChrystal converts his battlefield experience into fighting the coronavirus. Plus, Trump's high-rated White House briefings despite uneven messaging. I'm joined by Trump confidant and 2020 campaign advisor David Urban. Then,
we should find a way to use our resources and our knowledge to test for the virus.
The co-discoverer of gene editing tool CRISPR tells our Walter Isaacson how her tech could target COVID-19.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, where we are still working from home and broadcasting to you from here as coronavirus continues to surge in the West. But here in the UK, officials report two consecutive days of declining numbers of cases. It's much too soon to talk about a trend, but it's welcome news nonetheless. After the first week of strict lockdown measures here, and the UK Deputy Chief Medical Officer is saying it could take 6 months for life to return to normal. The Russian capital Moscow is now entering a strict quarantine. Meantime, India's been under lockdown for a week, and it's hitting the poorest hardest. This video shows some of the poorest self-isolating in trees to try to protect their families. In the United States, as expected, President Trump has had to reverse himself after calling for things to get back to normal by Easter. Conditions have forced him to extend social distancing until the end of April. And he's also saying that if only 100,000 die from coronavirus, that would be a success, while the UK says it will have done well to keep deaths under 20,000. Well, my next guest might have a different opinion. Beth Cameron was the Senior Director for Global Health Security and Biodefense on the White House National Security Council, and she is also the author of a now reportedly unused pandemic playbook, which was drawn up for the White House for precisely the kind of crisis that we're facing now. And she is joining me from Washington. Beth Cameron, welcome to the program. Tell me about this pandemic playbook that you authored, and when and why was it written?
So the pandemic playbook was written by a group of experts, not just me, but I did oversee its creation under the direction of our National Security Advisor and Homeland Security Advisor. The reason that we created it was coming out of the Ebola epidemic in 2014, we realized as a government that we really needed a set of decision-making capabilities within the White House that would allow us to really quickly understand if an outbreak or an epidemic was becoming something more, what had the potential to become a global crisis. And that was for a number of reasons. Ebola in West Africa wasn't usual. It usually happens in Central Africa, and the communities in West Africa weren't really used to dealing with Ebola. And so factoring that in, as well as just some characteristics of the disease itself, cultural differences in the communities that were most affected by Ebola, we realized that we would have been able to see much sooner that this could have become the crisis that it ultimately became. But most importantly, coming out of the Ebola epidemic, we knew that we and the world were not prepared for something worse than Ebola, a respiratory disease agent with human-to-human transmission like the coronavirus, like COVID-19 that we're seeing now. So we put in place a series of questions to ask ourselves so that we could make better decisions.
So what were the questions? How, and do you think that playbook would have been useful had it been used in the early days of this epidemic? Would it have been useful for the United States?
Definitely, it would have been useful for the United States. The goal was really to ask questions at all levels of government. So starting with White House decision makers, we were asking ourselves questions like, should we be looking at our personal protective equipment at varying stages during an epidemic or a pandemic? Does this call into question that we should be talking more with FEMA if we have a stronger need to respond in the United States, or working more carefully with our global partners? And so it was basically, it's now, I think, scanned in online. It was a public, it was a document that is unclassified, but originally not for public distribution. And it outlines the questions that you would ask up the chain to senior leaders in the White House, but more importantly, the questions that you would ask departments and agencies. For example, do we have testing capability? For example, do we have enough supplies, ventilators, and equipment? And so it's really a rubric, not to tell exactly what decision to make, but to allow everyone to ask the right questions constantly and consistently so that better decisions could be made as quickly as possible, recognizing that time is really the one commodity that we don't have during a pandemic.
So to the best of your knowledge, it wasn't used, right? I mean, these are the very questions that are facing the United States and many countries right now: testing, PPE, and all the other emergency ventilators and all the things that people need to respond to this crisis, public health measures. Why was it not used, to the best of your knowledge?
So two quick things. One, the reason that it wasn't used, I don't really know the reason that it wasn't used. It was reported that it hasn't been used, and I think that it certainly would have been useful had it been used. But I think that it would have been most useful in the beginning phases of this crisis, so in early to mid to late January, as the crisis was turning into a public health emergency of international concern, because that's the point at which decision makers are really unclear about how to handle something, where time is of the essence, and there might be a decision that takes 2 or 3 days, where if it could be made more quickly, or if a backup plan could be put in place, it could really save time. Now, at this point in the crisis, I think we really are where we are, which is that we have a massive pandemic around the world, and certainly in our own country, where we don't know who has the disease because we don't have massive testing capabilities in place, but where we really need that capability as quickly as possible, in addition to really getting our supply chain in order so that we have personal protective equipment, workers, and hospital supplies ready to deal with what we have. So definitely would have been useful then. I think now, we are where we are.
But it's important because it's about lives, and lives matter. And I just want to ask you, because and we have a quote from a former national security official, and this was reported by Politico, who broke the story of this pandemic playbook that apparently remained on the shelf. And the official in the Trump administration said in a week ago, "We're aware of the document, although it's quite dated, and it's been superseded by strategic and operational biodefense policies published since. The plan we are executing now is a better fit, more detailed, and applies the relevant lessons learned from the playbook and the most recent Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo to COVID-19. What's your reaction to that? Was your playbook dated?
I don't think it was dated. It is definitely true that this administration did put out a national biodefense strategy in 2018. And that strategy is really geared towards telling departments and agencies what kinds of gaps they should be looking at over the long term. The playbook was for a fundamentally different purpose. The playbook was specifically for leaders in the White House to guide them towards the types of questions they should be asking the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, in order to get information that the White House would need, and also to be able to lead at moments when it might be less clear to departments and agencies what kinds of decisions to make. And so the two are not mutually exclusive in any way, but the playbook was for a fundamentally different purpose. It was for White House decision makers, not for departments and agencies, although they were heavily consulted in its development.
President Trump is saying that, you know, he's now going to listen to the experts. He says that he's been listening to the experts. But in the wake of having to extend this social distancing time period from what he hoped would be Easter Sunday to the end of April, at the very least, he's saying he's going to listen to the experts before making another call. And of course, the big expert is Dr. Anthony Fauci. And he has said that if one could keep in the United States deaths to 100 or 200,000, that, you know, that might be, I mean, it's horrible to say, but that might be a success. I just want to play what Anthony Fauci said to CNN today.
I think, you know, if you look at seasonal flu, we had a bad season in 2017-18. We lost over 60,000 people just in a seasonal flu. This is clearly worse than that. So I would not be surprised. I don't want to see it. I'd like to avoid it. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw 100,000 deaths.
Again, they seem like enormous numbers, and I'm not sure whether you can address numbers. But what do those figures say to you? Are you do they kind of match with the wargaming or the playbook that you co-authored?
So I'm not prepared to comment on exactly how many deaths we might see in America or around the world, but those numbers don't surprise me at all based on the modelers and other scientific experts that I'm consulting with now on a daily basis. In fact, I think those numbers are projections that would require social distancing to remain in place for a period of time. And I think it was very good that President Trump extended the social distancing guidance in the United States past Easter. I think, quite frankly, we're in a position where we don't know how many deaths will come from this disease or how many deaths will come from a lack of preparedness in our hospital system, which is overwhelmed in many states right now handling COVID-19 and isn't therefore as available to handle all of the other health crises that hospitals usually handle. So unfortunately, I do think that number is realistic. It might even be an underestimate unless we're able to keep the strong social distancing measures in place and expand them, quite frankly, around the country.
Beth Cameron, I want to read also just a quick tweet from Brett McGurk. He's been a frequent guest on this program, and he obviously has worked for several administrations, Republican and Democrat, and he was last the sort of task force point man on fighting ISIS. In any event, he has pointed out that President Trump continues to say on Fox and Friends and Fox News that no one could have predicted this pandemic. He says, you know, this is flatly untrue. And he says, you know, if Trump says coronavirus came out of nowhere, last year the DNI warned that we were vulnerable to a pandemic that could lead to massive rates of death and disability, severely affect the world economy, strain international resources. How do you feel in your gut when you hear world leaders, whether it's the president of the United States or others, saying, well, we had no idea this could have hit anybody?
Christiane, it's one of the most frustrating things about this pandemic for so many of us that work on this issue. Look, this was not explicitly anticipated that this exact event would happen, nor that it would be affecting developed countries in quite the way that it is in Europe and the United States. But the fact that we're facing a pandemic is something that absolutely everyone who works in this field was aware would happen. We also, you know, given the globally interconnected nature of our world, given increasing likelihood that there could be accidents or even deliberate use of a biological weapon by a terrorist group or a state, many of us have been preparing for this moment and warning that it could occur. And so I think, it is surprising to hear leaders say that they didn't anticipate a pandemic. I do think, however, that it is very clear that the world leaders in general, not just in the United States, were not adequately preparing both financially or from a health systems perspective for the reality of this kind of event. And I think one of the things that I haven't seen enough reporting about in the United States in particular is the impact of this global crisis for months and years to come around the world, especially in developing countries, low resource, low income countries, where we're going to see major challenges dealing with this and where we have really a global supply chain that is really struggling to provide personal protective equipment to New York City. Can you imagine what that supply chain is dealing with in places around the world, in sub-Saharan Africa, in South Asia, in Southeast Asia? And so I'm really concerned about how we're going to get world leaders focused on preparedness for the future, even while we're in the middle of handling this crisis right now.
Exactly. And of course, we're going to dig into that because the next wave may very well be in the Southern Hemisphere and in the more developing countries, and their public health systems are not clearly not as good as in the United States. But, you know, you said this particular pandemic wasn't predicted, but in 2019, Johns Hopkins Public Health School did actually show an assessment of about 195 countries around the world. The U.S. had good marks. It had about 80 out of 100, but many countries were just about 40 out of 100. And where the U.S. fell down, it was successful in detecting, but it fell down in coping, in addressing, and in its health system. So this really does leave a huge number of questions for the future, because if another one comes, it might be even worse than this.
Absolutely true. And actually, our organization, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, is the co-investigator on that index. So that's a project of my team and I with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. And absolutely, you're right. One of the things we really struggled with in releasing that index is we chose purposefully not to give any color a green mark on the map. And so even though the U.S. got high marks, it's still yellow. It's not green. And we looked at the scores for the United States, and we felt that a low 80 mark was a flat B, and it wasn't good enough. Frankly speaking, looking at our response, we've underperformed relative to what I think we're capable of. But even looking deeper into the index and into the scores, there were some interesting things that we found about public confidence in government, about our access to healthcare and our health system that I think are now really being played out in real time. In addition to that, you know, we made a few recommendations in that index, including that there should be a Global Health Security Challenge Fund, an initiative for helping countries get prepared. Coming out of Ebola, lots of countries assessed themselves and got assessed by the World Health Organization to show that they weren't prepared and to identify really specific gaps. But what hasn't happened is there haven't been financial incentives to actually fill those gaps. So we have a lot of work to do.
Yes, and you wrote the book on all of this. Beth Cameron, thank you so much for joining us. Really important to ask these questions so that the next time one is not so unprepared. So extraordinary times do require an extraordinary response, of course, and some are highlighting the logistical might of the United States military to be deployed right now. My next guest is the retired four-star general, Stanley McChrystal. He led special operations in Iraq after 9/11, which led to the killing of the notorious al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And he led U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan. His consultancy firm has been recruited by Boston, the city of Boston, to review that city's coronavirus plans. And he's also author of the book, Leaders, Myth and Reality. He's joining me from Alexandria, Virginia. Stanley McChrystal, welcome to the program. And let me just start by asking you what you know best, and that is the military capacity of the United States, which is usually obviously deployed abroad, but there are provisions to deploy it in country when there are crises like this. What is your response to that? Should it be? Has it been?
First, Christiane, thanks for having me on. And the answer is the Department of Defense, all of the service members and the civilians involved and their families are part of the nation. I think that in their hearts and souls, they want to be a part of defending the nation against even this kind of a threat, a pandemic as opposed to a traditional enemy. So my answer to you is we need to maintain the capability to defend against traditional threats that might attack, but also we need to turn every bit of Department of Defense we can against this particular threat to help the American people.
So we just heard from Beth Cameron. I mean, and she says, you know, that there was a playbook, but one has lost critical months and weeks. What would you say to others who basically say, look, the U.S. has this amazing logistics capability. You know, I've seen it in the field when you've all deployed for war, and it's a methodical, huge, heavy lift that the U.S. does better than anybody. Can that be deployed, and in which way would it be useful in the U.S. right now, as well as the Army Corps of Engineers?
Well, let's talk wider than just Department of Defense assets. If you want to win a war, traditionally, what you try to do is break up your enemy and defeat him in detail. Napoleon was asked what enemy he'd most like to fight, and he responded, a coalition, because he felt that the different nations would not pull together and he could defeat them separately. If you want to lose a battle or lose a war, what you do is you allow yourself to defend yourself separately. So what I'd say is if we fight 50 different fights against COVID-19 by all of the states and then add to that the territories, if we fight them individually and we allow each to have to stand on its own, then our ability to be effective is going to be pretty limited. And we're seeing some of that. We are seeing the fact that states are competing against each other in cases where they have to. And we're not massing our capability to provide focus where it's needed most at the time it's needed. So I would say, first and foremost, even before we think about what Department of Defense assets, we've got to get a system to pull together all the different parts of our nation, the governmental parts, the commercial parts, and just the non-governmental parts, the people who want to help, bring them into a unified effort. And I think we've struggled so far with that.
Let me ask you then about that, because part of that unified, I guess, I mean, there are many elements to it, clearly, but the Defense Production Act, which has been invoked, but not you know, let loose, so to speak. Max Brooks, who is the son of Mel Brooks, but has done a lot of work on this stuff and who lectures at the Naval Academy, etc., recently said in an interview that there were ways, and, you know, forgive me, but the Defense Production Act could allow the federal government to go to the condom factory in Missouri and say, listen, you've got barrels of latex. We need those to make latex gloves. And we're requisitioning them and sending, you know, to the factory in Ohio. And then we're going to send the made gloves to New York, and et cetera, et cetera. Why hasn't that happened yet, and should it happen in all ways?
Well, I can't speak why it hasn't happened, but I think it should happen. If you think about it, firms want to help. And so in a perfect world, you say, well, we'll let everybody volunteer to help in the best way they can. But the reality is firms have stockholders. They have different equities pulling them in the directions. So a leader has a difficult time suddenly turning his firm or her firm into supporting production. So the Defense Production Act really provides shelter for them. It allows the government to bring things into effective coordination and synchronization, and allows firms to do that without having to make a misstep in the business sense.
The president has now invoked it after about 9 days. He's ordering General Motors to make ventilators, and he's named his trade czar to be the logistics czar for this. But let me ask you about leadership. You know, you wrote the book on that. You've been called in by the city of Boston to try to help them fight this. Just in terms of leadership, what are you seeing as a sort of a front against this enemy?
Yeah, I think we are starting to see more and more leadership across the country, and it's spreading widely and people are rising up. But what do you want? First off, in the case of a pandemic or a great crisis, because now we have a pandemic, which is a viral amorphous threat, an enemy that's hard to put our arms around. And so the average American and person in the world is frightened. And we have this economic crisis, and we're not even quite sure how that's going to affect each of us in the long term. So it's uncertain. So what do you want from your leaders? The first thing you want is someone who is candid and honest all the time. You need to have them tell you what they believe the truth to be, using the best data available. You don't want them to sugarcoat it, because when things change, immediately you realize that they are not being honest with you, and so you start to doubt all the information you get. You want them to be inspirational to build your confidence, but that doesn't mean by negating the truth. I think what you want from confidence is you want the commitment that we are going to beat this. Think of the summer of 1940 when Winston Churchill became the Prime Minister of Great Britain. He couldn't offer a high degree of confidence. They'd just been run out of the continent of Europe. But what he said was, we will not quit. We will never surrender. We'll fight on the beaches, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I think we need from the leader. And then from a management standpoint, we need a leader who brings people together. We need a leader who brings individuals together, but also teams together, brings the states together, brings municipalities together, gets people operating as a team of teams so that we're stronger than each of us would be separately.
General Stanley McChrystal, thank you so much indeed for joining us this evening.
You're kind to have me.
There really is only this one story dominating the news across the world, while so many important issues are falling off the radar, like the 2020 presidential election, at least for the Democrats for now. It is serving President Trump, though, as his daily briefings deliver huge ratings and his highest poll numbers yet. But some of the things he says from the podium are misleading at best. Joining me from Fort Myers, Florida, is David Urban. He is President Trump's confidant, and he's an advisor on his 2020 re-election campaign. David Urban, welcome back to the program.
Christiane, thank you for having me.
Now, we talked a couple of weeks ago as this crisis was ramping up, and I want to know whether you still think that that things are going as they should do from the White House. You were a little critical back then, saying there needs to be a much more coordinated effort, listening to the experts. So what do you make first of President Trump having said that he wants to reopen the country for business by Easter and now actually listening to the experts and having to, in fact, extend social distancing?
Well, Christiane, I at the time, supported the president's position. I think what he said at the time was it is aspirational. He'd like to see it. Doesn't know, if you go back and look at his exact words, said didn't know if he'd be able to do it. It was aspirational. Would like to see it opened. But obviously, he would consult with Dr. Fauci and Dr. Bricks and others. And he did so and determined that it wouldn't be plausible, wouldn't be possible to do it at this time. And so extended it for another 2 weeks, which I think is the responsible thing to do.
And he may even have to extend it beyond that. I mean, look, we're hearing all over that this may be, you know, several months before there's an ability to get back to normal. But I just wonder,
Christiane, you've heard from General McChrystal.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's a little bit of a lag here. I would just say that, and I would encourage your viewers to not take my word for it or anybody else's word. You can go. There's a great resource available that I would say. I'm just going to look at the website so I don't get it wrong. www.healthdata.org, which is run out of the University of Washington. It's the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IMHE, which has an incredibly detailed model of different countries, and in the United States does. The United States predicts beds needed, ICUs, ventilators, does it across the United States and state by state, predicts that the United States will have peak demand, will peak the coronavirus crisis here in the United States on April 15th will be the peak for the nation, and then breaks it down state by state and gives you a really in-depth look at it. And I would, instead of people, you know, kind of opining and guessing, they can look at the experts. This is one site that experts, I think, is very useful. And I've heard is being relied on by lots of different folks. So,
yeah, as you know, David Urban, the president has the best experts arrayed around him on that podium every day. Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Deborah Birx. I mean, these are very, very major experts. And I just wonder,
absolutely,
since we're talking about experts, what you make of a pretty loud voice online of president's supporters who are just denigrating Anthony Fauci. And, you know, the whole nonsense about conspiracy theories and, oh, he's just trying to take down the president. I mean, really, at this time, that can happen?
Well, listen, so Christiane, I don't think politics has any place in the current form, right? I don't think it's it should be People on the Trump side should be denigrating Dr. Fauci. I don't think Speaker Pelosi should be denigrating the president. I think what people in America want to see is kind of the cooperation and collaboration you've seen between Governor Cuomo and President Trump and Governor Newsom and President Trump. I mean, there are people who are not even close on the ideological spectrum who are working together and cooperating and talking despite their very, very strong differences. I think that should be the model for how all Americans are moving forward during this incredibly trying time in our nation's history.
I want to ask you, because again, you're former military, a couple of things. You've seen this pretty massive airlift coming in from China now. I mean, we're used to seeing the U.S. do massive airlifts of aid to many, many other parts of the world. But the Chinese have there's been a civilian plane chartered with a huge amount of required equipment from China, and there may be many more. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so Christiana, a couple things. You had asked General McChrystal, who I have a great deal of admiration for, about the military. The military is really surging forward here in lots of different ways. You correctly point out the Army Corps has gone up to the Javits Center in New York and building out hospitals and converting hotel rooms to bed space. They're sending two hospital ships to both the one to the East Coast, one to the West Coast. The military is surging greatly. Of interest, though, you should note that the primary response for the military in these types of situations is each state's National Guard. In the state of New York, for example, it's the 42nd Infantry Division. They have roughly 20,000 individuals who serve in that unit. And I believe to date, there have only been about 3,000 of those folks called into action. So I think before any, there's a federal response by the U.S. military. Each of these guard units would be called up and mobilized. As to the air bridge from China, unfortunately, this is what the president and lots of others here in the United States are pointing to. Nothing's made in America anymore. So PPE, you know, the protective equipment, parts for respirators, lots of the things that we need to move forward throughout this crisis are made overseas. And so it's very difficult to get them here. We'd love to see more respirators made here, but it's hard to turn a car factory into a respirator factory very quickly. These are complex medical pieces of equipment, and it's very difficult to do. And you talked about with General McChrystal about the Defense Production Act. I think lots of folks have been kind of bellying up to the bar, so to speak, and offering to make things. The challenge is getting some of those critical parts, which come from certain factories in China, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, there's a challenge also with kind of saying it as it is. You know, it's ridiculous to invoke the idea of nationalization like the president did, comparing, you know, getting companies to do something in a time of crisis to Venezuela, which is a total basket case. I mean, it's just not the apples and oranges, isn't it there? And the other thing I want to ask you is, you heard Stanley McChrystal say one of the things a great leader has to do in times of crisis is level with the people. Don't dissemble. Don't say one thing one day and have to retract it another day. Don't try to play down a crisis. So I'm trying to figure out what you think of, you know, President Trump suggesting, for instance, coronavirus was comparable to flu or death toll over car accidents. You know, all of that kind of stuff. In your view, has that been helpful, or is it just added to a sense of some confusion and sort of haphazardness, certainly at the beginning of the response to this crisis?
Well, Christiana, I would say in the clip you just ran there a few moments ago, you had Dr. Fauci talking about total number of deaths. And Dr. Fauci said, look, this could there could be a range. It could be upwards of X and downwards of Y. And he used the flu comparison there as well. So even the best experts use comparisons to try to give a frame of reference. I think what the president's trying to do, what he tried to do initially was, and continues to try to do, is to provide hope for the American people. He steps back, he lets Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and others answer the substantive questions, but he tries to be optimistic, hopeful, and aspirational. I don't think those two are incompatible.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something about how the U.S. has been looked at from overseas, while all these other countries, all your allies, are facing the same issue. You know, Angela Merkel has done an amazing job. Everybody says that, you know, the testing and all the sort of very rigorous moves that she has brought in has been very, very important. And in fact, there was a tweet just a couple of days ago whereby the Germans were telling people in the United States, their citizens, to get back to Germany ASAP to be able to, you know, have a chance over there, which is pretty extraordinary when you think about it. And on the other side, you've got Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, who's busy saying, let's go out. This is just overhyped by the media. We need to, you know, take care of our economy and this and that. In Brazil, you've got organized crime leaders in the favelas keeping social distancing because the government's not doing it. Just talk to me a little bit about leadership for a moment.
Yeah, look, I think there is, during these times of crisis, I think it is important. I think, look, you don't have to take my word for it or your word for it. I think the American people are speaking. You see this most recent Gallup poll, most recent Washington Post, ABC News poll. 60% of the people in the Gallup poll feel the president's doing a very positive job, very good job handling this crisis. In the Washington Post, ABC News poll, 51% of the people do. I think the way you see the president leading through this is the lens that you view it from him from to begin with. So I think he's doing a good job. I know there are others that don't share that feeling, but I think he is listening to the experts. I think he defers to the experts. I think he starts each day with these briefings, gives them an overview, and then steps back and lets the Surgeon General speak, Director of the CDC, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx. So I don't see where the president is not leading from the front here.
So you just mentioned those polls, and I was actually going to come to that because it's true. His poll ratings are up. I believe, though, the ABC Washington Post one is 49% approval, 47% disapproval. It's the highest, but it still is not cracking 50%. Why do you think that?
Look, Christian, I always say, you know, during the campaign, during the 2016 campaign in the state of Pennsylvania, which the president won for the first time in a Republican won for the first time in 30 years, when we won the election, the president was at 39%. So I'm not quite sure that there's a lot of I'm not quite sure the accuracy or veracity of polling is an accurate reflection of the mood. I think it's one tool to measure, but it's not necessarily an overall tool. And again, as I say, it point out, I believe that where you come at this is where you where you sit. If you like the president, you think he's doing a good job. If you don't like the president, you don't think he's doing a good job. And those numbers are reflective of his overall numbers throughout his presidency.
Last question, because it's you know, the president being the president, or Trump doing a Trump. His tweet yesterday, in which he quoted an article about the ratings now on television for the Daily Briefing, he tweeted, "President Trump is a ratings hit. Since reviving the Daily White House Briefing, Mr. Trump and his coronavirus updates have attracted an average audience of 8.5 million on cable news, roughly the viewership of the season finale of The Bachelor." So he's repeating what was written. Obviously, the rest of what was written was that stuff that we've just talked about. Some of the information in those briefings are misleading or just wrong sometimes. But what do you make of that? I mean, the president loves those ratings.
Right. Listen, the president understands the television, the media of television better than any other president in modern history. I think he views them as that he's been able to get his message out to many people across the United States, and he feels that there's success by those pure raw numbers. I think it's pretty self. I think it's I don't have to explain. I think it speaks for itself. The tweet speaks for itself.
And so very, very finally, I mean, it's not really, I don't know whether it's the right time to talk about this, but, you know, where do you put him for the November election? Because this, obviously, this crisis, for obvious reasons, has knocked the election campaign right off the map for the moment.
Yeah, Christian, you know, it's obviously, you know, when you and I last met a few weeks ago, the beginning of March, you know, no one, you know, you couldn't anticipate that this level, we'd get to this level all across the globe. I don't want to make any projections. You know, I hope and pray everybody and their families across America and across the globe get through this with minimal loss of life. We're obviously going to have a huge economic disruption around the world. I think that we need to focus on that to begin with, getting families healed, individuals healed, businesses back going. And then we can really begin an earnest discussion of the election, which will be coming up this November. But we have lots of time between now and then.
I hear you. David Urban, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now, the WHO has said that the best way to tackle this virus is to test, test, test. This is a call to action that pioneering biochemist Jennifer Doudna and her colleagues at UC Berkeley are working on now as they aim to use their biology labs to test up to 2,000 samples per day. Doudna, co-founder of the gene editing tool CRISPR, is using that technology to try to fight COVID-19, as she explains to our Walter Isaacson now. And full disclosure, of course, Walter is currently writing a book on Doudna and her work with CRISPR.
Dr. Jennifer Doudna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
In early March, when you watched the spread of the coronavirus, you suddenly decided it was time for scientists to kick into action. So you took your Berkeley lab and some of the surrounding labs in the San Francisco area, and you mobilized them. Tell me what you did and why.
We held a meeting to discuss how the scientists at UC Berkeley and our surrounding institutions could get together and address this terrible pandemic. And one thing that emerged from that meeting was that we should find a way to use our resources and our knowledge to test for the virus. Many of us agreed that one of the most important things to be done right now to address the disease is to understand who's infected and how to keep others safe.
And if you decide you're going to test, you do a regular test, but you have to get it approved, right, by the CDC. And once you've done that, what can you do, 500, 1,000 tests per day?
So it's important to understand, we're academic scientists. We don't do clinical testing. To do clinical tests with patient samples requires regulatory approval from multiple agencies. So we've been on a very fast track to learn, first of all, what kind of regulation do we need to comply with? How do we ensure compliance? And how do we get our scientists trained to work safely under these conditions and do it very fast? So we've been fortunate that the state of California, under its emergency declaration, has made it easier to get approval. The Food and Drug Administration at the federal level has also been very cooperative in helping us to do this. And as a result, we are really getting very close to being able to do a high throughput test for patient samples at UC Berkeley.
Many other universities' labs are being shut down, like with the rest of the university. Do you think it would be a good idea for universities around the country to get permission to keep their biology labs open and shift them over to this thing of testing so every community could have a high throughput testing center?
Well, I would first say that, you know, we're inspired by the University of Washington. Many people may be aware that their folks there, scientists, have been testing patient samples for weeks, and they've played a big role, actually, in helping to stem the spread of the SARS-CoV-2 virus up in the Seattle and larger area in Washington State. So we're inspired by this. I think it's incredibly important that people be working safely at this time. So we're very cognizant of having to use low density laboratory conditions, making sure that our scientists are appropriately protected physically from any potential for infection. But yes, I mean, I think beyond that, you know, if those conditions can be met, then I think having scientists working at this time and contributing their expertise to fight this pandemic is very valuable.
You've said SARS-CoV-2. Is that the same as the COVID-19 and the coronavirus we've been talking about?
Yeah, so let's do a little terminology check. So I've had to learn this myself. So SARS-CoV-2 refers to the actual virus that is causing the current pandemic. Coronaviruses are the family of viruses. That's the family of viruses that SARS-CoV-2 belongs to. And COVID-19 is the terminology for the disease that this virus causes.
You'll be doing the type of tests we've been doing for the past couple of months, which is just a test for the presence of the virus. I've noticed that now in Britain and other places, they're starting to do antibody tests. Can you explain the difference?
Right. So the test that we're doing at Berkeley is a test that looks at the virus RNA. It's the genetic material that allows the virus to replicate in upon infection. So we're using a test called the polymerase chain reaction that's approved by the World Health Organization and the CDC. It's a standard test. And importantly, it's able to detect the presence of the virus very soon after infection. So the difference between that type of a test and what you're asking about, what we call a serological test that looks for antibodies to the virus, is that typically when someone gets exposed to the virus and their body makes antibodies, it takes a while for that to happen. So it's really a test that looks after the fact. Has someone been infected by the virus? Also very useful to know, obviously, and to figure out who has immunity to the virus. But one of the challenges right now with those types of tests, as I've been learning, is that the testing materials are not accurate enough to ensure detection of just the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Right now, there's a lot of cross-reactivity with other types of viruses. And of course, many, many virologists and scientists are working on this problem, and they'll probably sort it out. But I think that's one of the challenges with those tests right now.
It's taking 4 to 6 days to get the results of some of these tests. Would you be able to do it like in a few hours or a day?
Yes, so that's a primary goal of our lab at Berkeley and the Innovative Genomics Institute is to be fast. So we have brought in high throughput robotic equipment. We've got companies helping us with data management. And we hope to be able to do 1,000 to 2,000 samples a day when we're rolling.
As you know, I'm writing a book about you and the discovery of CRISPR, which is the gene editing technology. And CRISPR, that technology, is based on a trick that bacteria figured out over the course of 3 billion years of how to fight viruses. Can you explain how CRISPR does that for bacteria?
Sure. So CRISPR is an adaptive immune system. It allows bacteria to detect viruses and protect themselves from future infection. And it's a system that a handful of scientists were studying. And then a few years ago, it was recognized that, you know, this system, which operates as an immune system, that we could actually harness it as a technology for something quite different, which is genome editing. And I think I've been reflecting on this during this pandemic. It's a fascinating parallel that bacteria have been dealing with viruses forever. They've had to come up with creative ways to fight them. And now here we are, humans, in a pandemic facing this challenge. And so we often think about, you know, how can CRISPR potentially impact this pandemic in ways that will be beneficial to humans?
Can CRISPR be used as a detection tool to help us detect the virus in ourselves?
So this is a really interesting use of CRISPR enzymes that takes advantage of something that my lab discovered about how they work, which is that in some cases, the enzymes are able to interact with a piece of nucleic acid, which is RNA or DNA. And when they do that, they turn on an activity, a capability that allows a big amplification of the signal. So in other words, for every molecule of virus RNA that gets detected, we can see many, many molecules of a reporter piece of nucleic acid, like a little piece of DNA, getting cut. And so there's a way to do that, use that activity such that there's a big release of a chemical signal that can be seen visually. And so you have the ability to use this CRISPR system to literally detect and then report on its detection of a piece of viral RNA very, very quickly.
So in other words, you can engineer it so that if it cuts something that's the virus we're talking about, it glows. It sort of has a phosphorescent or some signal. Does that mean you could have home detection kits that could do it quickly and anybody could just look at it the way they could a pregnancy test and say, okay, I've got it?
That's the idea. Absolutely. I think that's a very interesting possibility of how this system could ultimately be used.
Are we talking a week, a month, or a year?
We're not talking a week. We may be talking months. I think we're less than a year from that. It's hard to say.
Now, we've been talking about detection, like how can you test and detect this. Let's talk about treatments for a second. I know that at Stanford, one of your friends and colleagues, Stanley Key, has come up with something he called Pac-Man, which is a way for the actually use a CRISPR-based system to actually attack the virus if somebody's sick. Tell us how that's progressing.
Yeah, so this is another kind of clever idea about how to use CRISPR enzymes to fight the viral infection. And the idea there is to literally, for those of you that remember Pac-Man, like I do, this is, you know, literally using enzymes that will go after and cut and destroy only the viral RNA and not RNAs that are present in normal cells. And so this is, I think, a clever approach. It's been tested in a laboratory setting, and there's some, you know, hope there that that looks like that technically it can work. I think the challenge is, how do you get that into a patient? How do you get it into infected cells?
And so if you wanted to get it into infective cells, you'd have to have a delivery mechanism. What are the delivery mechanisms?
Well, it's very difficult because in the infection with this virus involves infection in the lung. And so we would need to have a way to deliver these CRISPR enzymes into lung cells. And that's something that's very hard right now. Fortunately, there's an effort at the Innovative Genomics to do exactly that for a different purpose, namely for treating cystic fibrosis, which is a lung disease that where we think eventually the CRISPR technology could have an impact.
So the notion that these CRISPR enzymes could cut up and chop away and destroy the COVID-19 virus in somebody's lungs, let me ask the same question. Is that months away, years away?
Probably years, honestly. I think we're trying to accelerate the pace of doing that sort of testing. But as you may know, that sort of test would require going into human patients and going through phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 clinical trials. So this is, you know, realistically, it's years.
Another thing CRISPR could do in theory would be to edit our own genes, and so that our cells don't have receptors that allow a particular virus to get in. Is that a possibility?
Well, that's a possibility in the long time future, I would say. It's certainly not something that will be, I think, effective in this particular pandemic. One of the challenges to taking that approach is that one has to know, first of all, which receptor to go after. And we do know that for the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But when we talk about a receptor for a virus, we're talking about a normal protein that's on the surface of a human cell. And as you can imagine, that could be problematic to try to remove it. It's probably there for a reason. So that's one thing. But then there's also the issue, as we just talked about, for the Pac-Man approach, that one has to figure out delivery and how to target the CRISPR proteins to cells where they could create protective changes. And I think that's, again, something that's going to take years to develop.
We say it will take years. Didn't we just have a world famous case a year and a half ago where a Chinese scientist, He Zhongqi, actually did that for the HIV virus receptor of a cell, but he was able to edit the embryos of kids so they no longer had that receptor and couldn't catch HIV. So you say it's a long time away, but it's already been done for one receptor, right?
Okay, well, there's a lot of ways to answer that question. First of all, I think the ethics of that study were unfortunately very flawed, and that study has been pretty roundly condemned by the international community. Beyond that, I would say that doing any kind of embryo editing is just impractical for multiple reasons, both technical and kind of ethical. And finally, one would need to know in advance which proteins to target. In the case of HIV, we do know about the receptor proteins for HIV infection, but for most viruses, or certainly for emerging viruses in the future, we can't necessarily predict.
When you put together a consortium that has various universities and philanthropies and foundations, did you in this case say, we're going to have a slightly different set of rules about to the extent to which we're going to try to profit from or use this in a proprietary way and instead share it?
Yeah, actually, that's been a topic of very active discussion, because I think many scientists, myself included, we don't want to be, we have no desire to profit financially from this. We really want to be contributing our expertise, and we're not seeking to profit from it. We are working with university officials to see if we can put out publicly a statement about how intellectual property will be managed for this pandemic, how we can make discoveries that are going to come from this large team of people that are now working on the problem, openly available so that it can be developed very quickly. And I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to do that quite fast. So stay tuned. We're hoping to make an announcement about that in the near term.
Dr. Jennifer Doudna, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
And we will be waiting for that announcement. And finally, in troubling times, celebrating love and connection is more important than ever. That is exactly what these two frontline epidemiologists demonstrated over the weekend. The happy couple decided to tie the knot at a hospital in Massachusetts. Only a few guests were there in surgical masks and seated 6 feet apart. The ceremony even ended with the couple bumping elbows. Couples around the world, from Hong Kong to Malaysia to Argentina and elsewhere, are finding creative ways to tie the knot. All of this, love in the time of corona, shamelessly stealing from Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.